So we started out talking about Jesus coming here to earth. And we stressed that when he came, he had two purposes. One was to die for sin, and the other was to establish his kingdom. And we know that those two had to go hand in hand. Jesus couldn't establish his kingdom and be the king over his kingdom without the cross being there. The cross was what elevated him to that status. So he had been with God in the very beginning, and he gave that up, and he came here to make sacrifice for sin and establish his kingdom. After we crucified him, he was in the grave for 3 days, rose again. And of course, that's wonderful news, and we talk about that a lot. But the part of it that we don't talk about a lot, or that I have not talked about a lot, is him going back to heaven. We call that the ascension. So now Jesus has gone back to heaven. And when he gets there, Daniel says, he sits down at the right hand of God, and he is now reigning over his kingdom. So his kingdom is established. Jesus is our king. It's not a physical kingdom like Jesus told us. It's a spiritual kingdom. Jesus couldn't come and sit on a throne in Jerusalem because one of Jesus' ancestors is Coniah. And Coniah had been so wicked that God had said, none of your seed will prosper on the throne in Jerusalem. But Jesus is now on David's throne. It's not in Jerusalem, it's in heaven. But he's nevertheless reigning. So that's the position he occupies right now. But, and this is important, Jesus left us with a promise. Jesus said, I will come again. And that's what we're going to focus on tonight. Now, I have a feeling we're not going to be able to get through the entirety of this discussion, but we'll continue it next week. So Jesus said he would return. And we're going to note the promise. Jesus makes the promise. The angels make the promise at the ascension. And then we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at the purpose for Jesus coming again. And then finally, we'll talk about what that means to us, knowing that that's the case. So in essence, what we're undertaking now at this part of our study is the study of something called eschatology. It's just a big word. And that word, according to Webster, concerns itself with the final events in the history of the world or of mankind. So eschatology or eschatological has to do with the end of the world. He goes on, Webster goes on when he defines this word. He says it's a belief concerning death, the end of the world, or the ultimate destiny of mankind. Any of the various Christian doctrines concerning the second coming, the resurrection of the dead, and the last judgment. Now, Webster is going to define the word the way that it's used in the English language. And there's frankly been a lot of confusion because people didn't look very carefully at what Jesus had to say. The Bible, in my view, points to a sudden terminal end of mankind, or I should say humankind, and the material universe that will be the result of divine intervention. In other words, God's going to do it. I don't know how he'll do it, but God is going to do it. It must be remembered that the Bible also points to other times when God has judged people. And sometimes biblical information presents those other judgments as a time when Jesus comes. And we'll talk about some of the other occasions when Jesus came after we finish this discussion of eschatology, because Jesus came on a number of different occasions. Remember, he promised, I'm going to come against the Jews and I'm going to carry them into captivity. In fact, he told Habakkuk, I'm going to work a work in your days which you will not believe, even though I tell you it. So Jesus tells Habakkuk, I'm going to come, I'm going to wreak judgment on the people of Israel, not a worldwide judgment. I'm going to wreak judgment on the people of Israel, and I'm going to carry them into Babylonian captivity. That judgment is sometimes in biblical information referred to as a time when Jesus came. He's the agent who operated on behalf of the Godhead. So just remember all of those things as we go through this discussion. There are some really important terms that are associated with Jesus' second coming. When we say second coming, remember, we're talking about the time when Jesus comes back to fulfill the promise that he'd made to the disciples and the promise that was made by the angels when Jesus left. This term coming is frequently the way that the Greek word parousia is translated. Excuse me. Let's look at just one illustration of this. This is a word that's used on a number of different occasions, parousia, throughout the Greek New Testament. And we're just going to look at one occasion of that. We're going to look at 1 John, the second chapter and verse 28. So this is the way John says it. Now, little children, and I'm reading from the King James translation tonight, abide in him, and of course that's abide in Jesus, that when he shall appear, we may have confidence and not be ashamed before him at his coming. There's that word that we're interested in, parousia. It's the Greek word, number 3952. If you're going to follow that in, if you have something like eSword and you're going to follow this, or Logos, or you have any of the Bible translations that you can search on the Greek word 3952. It's parousia. And Vine, who defines a lot of the Greek words, by no means does Vine define them all, but Vine defines at least some of those Greek words. Well, W. Vine said it denotes an arrival and a consequent presence with. So it refers to him coming and then staying with. It's an acute sense of expectation and excitement that we've all felt. And he illustrates it this way. It's the kind of excitement that we feel when we anticipate the arrival of a dear one from whom we have been absent for a considerable time. So think back to all of those YouTube videos that you've seen of dad returning from an overseas deployment, and he comes into a gym and surprises his daughter, and she is just ecstatic that he has come. That's this term, parousia. That's a term that's used to describe his second coming. Then there's a second word that is used in the Greek language to talk about this second coming. And this is the word P-H-A-I-N-O, or an associated word, E-P-I, P-H-A-N-E-I-A. And I can't pronounce either of those Greek words. I'm not even going to try, but it's the word that came into the English language as epiphany. In the King James translation, this word is generally translated as an appearing or to appear. So let's look at Hebrews 9 and verse 28. We're going to see this word in Hebrews 9 at verse 28. He says, so Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many, and unto them that look for him shall he appear. There's that word. It's the Greek word 3700. He says, to them that look for him shall he appear the second time without sin unto salvation. And we'll talk more about what that phrase means, that he's going to appear without sin unto salvation. But at this point, I just want you to see how that word is used. And as you can see from the slide that's on the screen, it's also used in Titus 2 at verse 13, Colossians 3 at verse 4. It's used frequently throughout the New Testament. It's an interesting word. In the active voice, it means to shine. And when I see this, now again, I'm quoting W. Vine. When I see this term to shine, what I think of is the transfiguration. Remember, Jesus glowed. His face was white as snow. So Jesus is glowing at the transfiguration. When it's used in the passive voice, it means to be brought forth into light, to become evident, or to appear. And that's the way that it's usually translated. It's a word that's used to refer to the grace of God, the kingdom, a person's true character. And you know, sometimes we hide our character, but then there are events that reveal it. It's used to refer to an angel. It's used to refer even to the prophet John. There are a lot of things that come to light or become evident. But again, ultimately, this is a word that's used to refer to the second coming of Christ, where Christ himself becomes evident. And then there's the term revelation. It's a translation frequently of this Greek word. It's, you can see it there. It's A-P-O-K-A-L-U-P-S-I-S. And again, I wish that I was a good enough Greek scholar to be able to pronounce these words, but I'm not. And I don't claim to be. I wish that I was. See, it's a word that's used in 2 Thessalonians 1. It's the word that came into the English language as apocalypse. Interesting word. We're going to look at, and I think I have the wrong citation there. I think I want 1 Thessalonians 1. And
I found it in 2 Thessalonians.
Where is it?
2 Thessalonians 1:7.
Okay. Maybe I had the wrong... Maybe I clicked on the wrong place in my program. Yes, there it is. It helps if I look at 2 Thessalonians 1:7. I must have been looking at 2 Timothy. So here's this word. It's the word is from the Greek word 602, and It says this. We should begin reading, I think, probably at 2 Thessalonians 1 at verse 6. He says, seeing it is a righteous thing with God to recompense tribulation to them that trouble you, and to you who are troubled, rest with us. When the Lord Jesus shall be revealed, there's that word, that comes into the English as apocalypse. He will be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels. And again, Vine says that this is a word that means an uncovering or an unveiling. And remember what we said. Jesus came here. He did the work that was assigned to him while he was here. He was crucified, raised from the dead. He went back to heaven. And so now he's hidden from us. He's still doing his work. And we know that heaven is real, but we can't see it. Okay. So he's going to be revealed from heaven. He's currently invisible to the naked eye, but will eventually be exposed, and we will see his reality. And I've stressed before that I think that's one of the reasons why Jesus came here to die on the earth, so that we could see that. And we would be able to see that God was not unrighteous when he had covered up the sin, or when he had forgiven the sins of David, even though Jesus has not died yet and made the sacrifice. But Jesus does come here and he makes the sacrifice, and that's what destroys Satan's biggest argument, which is really deception, that God's unrighteous because he forgave you without a sacrifice. Well, we can say, no, the sacrifice was made. And I can be sure that the sacrifice was made. So these are the terms that are used biblically to talk about this idea of the end of the world when Jesus comes the second time. Questions at this point. I can't see all of you at the same time, so I have to kind of scroll across here. Okay. Now let's talk about the promise that this was going to happen. Jesus is the first person that makes the promise. Can I get somebody to read John 14, 1 through 3, and then drop down and read 27 through 29?
Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive to you myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Verse 27, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful. You have heard that I say to you, I go away and I will come to you. If you love me, you would have rejoiced because I go to the Father, for the Father is greater than I. Now I have told you before it happens, so that when it happens, you may believe.
Okay. So I think that what John is recording here is Jesus' encouragement to the disciple. You remember how very difficult it was for them to maintain their faith in Jesus and the whole program that he came to accomplish. After Jesus was crucified, they went back to being fishermen and doing whatever they had been doing before they became Jesus' disciples. So it's, I feel for them. I know how hard it was for them to put their faith in this. And then it seems like everything is destroyed. But Jesus gives them this assurance. He says, I go to prepare a place for you. I realize that I'm going away. And we know that one of the things that he did when he left was to send the Holy Spirit to, and this is a bad way to say it, to kind of tide us over, to keep us knowledgeable of him while he's up in heaven. The Spirit is down here and the Spirit is helping us, so that we don't get defeated. But he says, I will come again. No question, Jesus is coming again. And it's a promise that is extended to all who believe, not just to the apostles or not just to the disciples that were with him when he made this statement, John 14. Let's look at John 12 and at verse 26. And there are a lot of other places that we could look where Jesus extends this promise that he made to the disciples. Can somebody read John 12 at verse 26?
If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him.
Thank you, Ralph. So ultimately, something is going to follow his second coming. He's told the disciples, I'm going away to prepare a place for you so that when I come again, you can be with me. And it's a promise that is extended to all disciples, not just those that specifically heard him on that occasion. question. Anybody have questions or comments at this point?
Dean?
Yeah.
I think the fact that he sent the Holy Spirit as a comforter, which was to remind us of, or to remind them of what Jesus said, and to let us know that what they wrote was validated by Jesus.
Good point. Good point. Imagine how hard it was for the disciples that had been with Jesus to maintain their faith. And they only had to keep going for 50 days. And they couldn't even make that happen. Well, in fact, not even 50 days, just a very short time when Jesus was with them in that period between his resurrection and Pentecost. That was 50 days. So Jesus was with them for at least 40 days, and he talked to them about all of these things. That I don't know how long it took for them to lose their sense of conviction and to slip back into what they had been before they started following Jesus. But it was fast. And Carol, you make a good point. Had it not been for the Spirit coming on Pentecost to accomplish what Jesus wanted it to accomplish, how hard would it have been for even the disciples, the people that were with Jesus every day for 3 years, to maintain their faith? And the Spirit, I think, does that for us as well. Doesn't do it in the same way it did for the disciples or for the apostles, but the Spirit keeps us going. Other comments? Again, this is not an exhaustive list of the places where Jesus promised that he would come again. In my mind, I always go to this one because it's so clear. There's just not much question that this is what Jesus was intending to do. Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit. Jesus makes his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. The people are shouting, "Hosanna, Hosanna to the King." And then within just a couple of days, they've turned around, and now the people are shouting, "Crucify him." So Jesus is crucified. That had been God's plan all along, because he wanted to make a sacrifice for sin, and he needed Jesus to go to the cross. But Jesus knew that he had to go to the cross. Satan had offered him the possibility of becoming king without the cross. The people wanted to make him king without the cross. But that couldn't happen. Anytime somebody tells you that people crucifying Jesus thwarted the plan of God, that Jesus come here and establish his kingdom, they're telling you something that assumes that he could have become king without the cross. And that's just not the case. I mean, that's the part of the Bible that makes me thankful that Jesus died. That's an exciting day. Now, it's a sad day, but it is an exciting day. So we go forward from the death. Jesus is buried. He's in the ground for 3 days. He's raised again on Sunday. He's with the disciples for 40 days after that. And then at the end of about 40 days, Jesus goes back to heaven. And last week, we talked about him going back to heaven. The disciples are with him. All of a sudden, Jesus is just taken up in the clouds. And from their perspective, they don't really know where he went. He just was taken up. Now, we know from comparing that to the statement that Daniel makes about his vision, Daniel shows us what he did when he was taken up. He came to the Ancient of Days with the clouds. He sits down. He is given all authority. He is on David's throne. Now it's in heaven. But this is the statement that the angels make to the disciples. They're standing there and must have had a dumbstruck look on their face. What on earth just happened? Maybe they were able to process it later and they were able to say, oh, I understand. This is what Jesus was talking about in John 14 when he said, I'm going to prepare a place for you. But at that moment, I'm not sure they understood all of this. So, and two men stood by them. This is Acts, the first chapter. Can somebody read Acts 1 and verse 11?
And they also said, men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into the sky? This Jesus who has been taken up from you into heaven will come in just the same way as you have watched him go into heaven.
Okay. So now we know what's going on. He went to heaven and the angel says he's coming back. And it's going to be in like manner as they saw him go into heaven. Now, I take that in like manner to refer to the clouds that accompanied him. It could be that the angel or the being that's the two beings that stood there with the disciples, it could be that they're saying it will be immediate. It won't be with any means of conveyance. It's not like he comes from heaven in a rocket ship and he lands on the earth. He just comes like he just left. So it could be the lack of a means of conveyance. It could be the suddenness. As I look at this, it seems to me that the angels are talking about him coming with clouds. But I can't be dogmatic about that. It means in like manner.
When you think about the apostles looking at this, just prior to this, they asked Jesus the question, are you going to come back and restore your kingdom, an earthly kingdom? And now that the angels are pointing out that Jesus ascended and he's going to come back again, they didn't realize this until second chapter when they received the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. Or didn't quite apprehend everything that it meant.
Exactly.
And we'll also next week, or maybe even the week after that, we'll be talking about the incident that Lenny was talking about. That incident is recorded for us in Matthew 24, when they Jesus has told them, look at the stones of the temple. 3 days I'm going to be in the ground. And he compares his bodily destruction to tearing down the temple. And so he's going to describe what is going to happen when that temple is destroyed. And that's one of those incidences that we have to be very careful to understand the context, to make sure that we don't compare apples and oranges.
Dean?
But good point, Lenny. Yeah.
So what you're saying with the comparison to the temple is the temple was God's earthly dwelling place, and he's going to destroy God's earthly dwelling, or the God's earthly dwelling place is going to be destroyed, and that the kingdom is in heaven. Is that what you're saying, or did I stretch that too far?
No, I think that's a good interpretation of what I'm saying. It wasn't just that the temple was, and I don't want to get too far into this because we will later. It's not just that the temple was destroyed, but the whole economy of the Old Testament was destroyed. All those sacrifices, all the rituals, the temple, the national promise, everything is destroyed. And to the Jewish mind, that was heaven and earth. In fact, that was an idiom that they used to describe their whole way of life. The whole theocratic mode of government. I mean, for a Jew, it wasn't just your religion. It was your nation. It was your laws. The whole theocratic system is taken out of the way. And that was really hard for them to conceptualize. That was, as far as they're concerned, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, that was the end of everything. Now, that's not the end of the world, and we'll see that as we continue our discussion. And we'll have to be very careful to make sure that we know the context in which these statements about the end are made. And we'll have to be very careful to be sure that we're taught, when we read some of the statements in Matthew 24, they're talking about the end of the Jewish system, not the end of the whole world. But if you're Jewish, that was the end of your world. And a lot of mistakes are made because people are not careful to distinguish between the two. Okay. Let's get to the purpose for which he's coming. The second time, the purpose is not the same as it was when he came the first time. We know Clearly his purpose when he came the first time was to establish his kingdom and to set up and to make sacrifice for sin, among other things. But those are the two really major purposes. When he comes the second time, it's a time when there's a complete separation between the just and the wicked. And it's complete. Everybody is involved. Now, Jesus kind of hints at this in some parables that he tells in Matthew, the 13th chapter. And let's read in Matthew 13. Need to get to Matthew here.
4:30.
Boy, the drop-down menu is really small. I have to put my glasses on so I can make sure I get to Matthew 13th chapter. And can I get somebody to start reading at verse 24 and to read down through verse 30?
Jesus presented another parable to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while his men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went away. But when the wheat sprouted and bore grain, then the tares became evident also. The slaves of the landowner came and said to him, 'Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?' And he said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' The slaves said to him, 'Do you want us then to go and gather them up?' But he said, 'No, for while you are gathering up the tares, you may uproot the wheat with them. Allow both to grow together until the harvest. And in the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, first gather up the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them up, but gather the wheat into the barn.'"
Okay. Now there's nothing here that says this is a second coming. It's not that specific. But it is specific about a judgment. Can we read verses 36 through 43? And again, I love that translation that you're reading from, Faye.
The last New American Standard, but S, double S.
So verses 36 through 43 is... Jesus explains the wheat and the tares. Go ahead, read that.
"Then he left the crowds and went into the house, and his disciples came to him and said, 'Explain to us the parable of the tares of the field.' And he said, 'The one who sows the good seed is the Son of God, and the field is in the world, is the world, and as for the good seed, these are the sons of the kingdom, and the tares are the sons of the evil one. And the enemy who sowed them is the devil. And the harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. So just as the tares are gathered up and burned with fire, so shall it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send forth his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all stumbling blocks and those who commit lawlessness, and will throw them into the furnace of fire, in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as a sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear."
Okay. And then there's another parable a little bit later. It's a parable of the dragnet. And it starts in verse 47. Can somebody read that? Verses 47 through 50?
Can read that.
And again, the kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet cast into the sea and gathering fish of every kind. And then it was filled, they drew it up on the beach, and they sat down and gathered the good fish into containers, but the bad they threw away. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth and take out the wicked from among the righteous and will throw them into the furnace of fire. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Have you understood all these things?
Okay. So we're talking about the end of something. Now, here in Matthew 13, the word that's used to describe what is ending is the age. That is the word, let me get that word for you. The end of the age is from this word G165, and it's, well, you see it there for you on the screen, A-I-O-N. It comes into the English as the word eon, or a long period of time. It's the end of an age. And ages end typically in a judgment. And usually that age ends when God comes in judgment. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the end of the world. Now that's the ultimate end of the age. And when we talk about the end of the world, as distinguished from the end of ages, the end of the world is usually from the word that comes into the English as cosmos. That's the Greek word 2889. It would be nice if we could say every time Jesus was talking about the end of the world, he used cosmos. And every time he was talking about the end of the age, he used the word eon or A-I-O-N. He didn't. The only way that we can know what Jesus is talking about is to look at the context in which Jesus uses that word. Here in Matthew, the 13th chapter, the word that he uses is eon, or A-I-O-N. He doesn't use cosmos here. Sometimes he does use the word cosmos. And if it's cosmos, then we know that we're talking about the end of the world. If he uses eon, it's the end of an age. And there have been a number of different ages. There was the patriarchal age, when God spoke directly to the fathers by the prophets. And that ended. Jesus, or God, established the Old Covenant, the Old Testament. And that age continued for the Jew until such time as God brought that to an end with Jesus. So, ages have come and gone. The world, the cosmos, has been fairly constant.
They don't seem?
Yeah.
In this, the sideline reference in the New American Standard said the end of the age is or consummation.
Right.
And in verse 49, the phrase is also used, the end right. of the age.
Yeah. In the King James, it uses the word world, but if you look it up, it's not cosmos, it's eon. And you make a good point. not just that this is the end of an age, it's the consummation of an age. So the old covenant, the old law, was our schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. So Jesus is the consummation of the whole Old Testament system. He's what it was intended to accomplish. And that's a very good point.
So this is the 95, but just another copy.
Which is another, it's just upgrade. 95 is the...
So I make this point to say that Jesus came on a number of different occasions. Sometimes his coming was to mark the end of an age or the end of a system. Sometimes it was to mark the end of the entire world. And the only way to know what Jesus is talking about is to look at the context. Even the word doesn't always help. But it's something that we can use as well. Other thoughts, comments? I think we can get through this discussion, this slide, and then we're going to take a break and we'll take up again with this later. So let's look at Luke 12. Again, Jesus he's not specifically saying that I'm talking about my second coming. What he's saying is these are some of the things that are like my second coming. Luke 12, and let's begin at verse 35 and read down through verse 48.
Be dressed in readiness and keep your lamps lit. Be like men who are waiting for their master when he returns from the wedding feast, so that they may immediately open the door to him when he comes and knocks. Blessed are those slaves whom the master will find on the alert when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will gird himself to serve and have them recline at the table. And will come up and wait on them. Whether he comes in the second watch or even in the third and finds them so, blessed are those slaves. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have allowed his house to be broken into. You too be ready. For the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect. Peter said, Lord, are you addressing this parable to us or to everyone else as well? And the Lord said, who then is the faithful and sensible servant or steward whom his master will put in charge of his servants to give them their rations at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that slave says in his heart, my master will be a long time in coming, and begins to beat the slaves, both men and women, and to eat and drink and get drunk, The master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, at an hour that he does not know. And he will cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. And that slave who knew his master's will and did not get ready or act in accord with his will receive many lashes. But the one who did not know it and committed deeds worthy of flogging will receive but few. From everyone who has been given much, much will be required, and to whom they entrusted much, of him they will ask all the more.
Okay. Now I think the point here is that Jesus' second coming is in some ways at an unspecified time. There have been people throughout history who have said that given all of the things that are included in the Old Covenant, the things that are included in the New Covenant, that they could tell exactly the day and the hour when Jesus was going to return. So far as I know, every one of them that's made a prediction has been easily shown to be false because their predictions were for dates that have already happened. And Jesus didn't come on that day. I had a book at one time that was written by Rutherford, who is of certain fame among the Seventh-day Adventists. That book was called Millions Now Living Will Never Die. I loaned that to a friend of mine, and he turned out to be a very good bookkeeper, but not a very good book returner. The people who thought that Rutherford was making a prediction would give anything to be able to buy that book back. In fact, when I owned it, they made me offers to buy it back, and I didn't take it. I kept that book and then gave it away and lost it. People make all kinds of fanciful predictions about when this coming is going to happen. But this passage, along with many others, I think, indicates clearly that nobody knows when it's going to happen. When it does happen, those people that are prepared will be rewarded. But the delay will be misinterpreted by some, and they'll say either, like some have said, God's promise is for naught. He's not coming again. Or they'll say, I know he's not coming for a good long while, so I'll just eat, drink, and be merry while he delays. In either case, you don't want to make that mistake. That's a foolish mistake. 2 Peter 3, and we'll spend some time in 2 Peter 3 on a later date, but 2 Peter 3, scoffers will come in the last days saying, where's the promise of his coming? Since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they have from the beginning. You religious fanatics are saying that Jesus is going to come again. And you people have been saying that for at least 2,000 years since Jesus died. That's a promise I'm not afraid of. I'm not concerned about that promise. And for those of us who want to be prepared, it's also hard to stay vigilant, to stay prepared, to stay ready, even if you want to stay ready. When there's a delay, it's hard to stay vigilant. I practice and I'm trying to get better at something called situational awareness, just knowing what's going on around me. You know, some people go through life kind of fat, dumb, and happy. They walk around, they've got their head buried in their phone, and you could walk up behind them and whack them on top of the head with a piece of iron, and they wouldn't ever see you coming. I try to be aware of my surroundings, and I can do that for a short period of time, but it's hard to maintain that vigilance for a long period of time. And even for those people that want to serve God, maintaining their awareness is really hard. So we'll continue this discussion next week. I knew that there was no way we'd get through all of this. But if there's anything that I think we can take away from this, it's from this discussion, it's this. Stay prepared. Jesus said he was coming again, and he will. No question, he will. I don't know when. It would be easier to stay prepared if I could tell you he's coming again in 14 days. But I can't tell you that. So we'll continue our discussion next week.